Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Nuclear Security Summit opened in Washington today. The focus of this unprecedented meeting of leaders and representatives from over 40 nations is to find a way of securing nuclear material and to keep it out of the hands of terrorists. Joining us in the studio is Joseph Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund, Stephen Rademacher. He's former Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration, and David Senger of the New York Times. Of course, we welcome your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good to have
you
here. Stephen Rademacher, this summit had a very somber start with the death of Poland's president in a plane crash on Saturday. Is anyone from Poland participating in the summit?
Well, regrettably, given the tragedy, the Prime Minister of Poland decided to stay home to preside over the events taking place in Warsaw and deal with the national tragedy that they are facing. The head of the Polish delegation to this event will be the Poland's ambassador here in Washington, Ambassador Robert Kupiecki, and I understand a deputy minister of energy will be arriving today to join him in leading the Polish delegation.
It truly is a horrendous event that this should happen. And apparently, from what we're told, the pilot was told not to land.
I've seen reports to that effect. I think there's an investigation underway, and we will soon learn the cause of the tragedy.
But, well,
I think that's secondary to the tragic loss that the people and government of Poland have
indeed,
suffered.
Indeed. We all send our condolences. Joseph Cirincione, outline for us the details, the goals of this nuclear summit.
Well, we've never had a nuclear summit like this. We've never had this many world leaders, heads of state, gathered to talk about nuclear policy any place. We've never had this many heads of state gathered in Washington. In fact, you have to go back to 1945 to the founding of the United Nations to find an event anything like this. That was in San Francisco then. And the focus of this is not on reducing existing stockpiles. That's something the president was doing last week with Russia. And it's not really on hostile states like Iran and North Korea. It's on what most security experts think is the number one threat to America and to many other countries, the threat of nuclear terrorism. And the key here is that while this is our number one threat, it's also our most preventable threat. You can stop nuclear terrorism if you stop terrorists from getting the one part of a nuclear bomb they can't make. That's the stuff, the cores of highly enriched uranium and plutonium. We know where most of this material is. It's held in some 40 countries around the world, enough for about 100,000 nuclear weapons. So you have to convince those countries to secure the material and eliminate it where possible. That's what President Obama is trying to do.
And David Senger, how does the president go about doing this?
Well, I think what's interesting, as Joe has indicated, is that by focusing just on the question of getting the current stocks either under control or eliminated, the president is trying to take almost all the international politics out of the summit meeting. You know, the most politically charged and divisive issues are about who gets to produce nuclear weapons, who gets to make more fuel. And we wrote this morning on the front page of the Times about India and Pakistan producing more, which we can return to later. But almost everyone is in agreement that the existing stores need to be either protected or blended down for use in a nuclear power plant. So I think that if there is a certain brilliance to the design of this summit, it's that it's taken the nuclear politics out of the issue.
But
that requires him then to get very specific commitments and work plans from each of the countries that's represented. And I think that's what they're trying to do. In an interview we did with the president last week, he said that he really despises gauzy communiques.
What does that mean?
That means some communique issued at the end of a summit that turns out some broad set of principles that has been watered down so everybody can agree with it, but it's not clear when everybody leaves what it is that they then go do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he wants to do now is emerge with each country with a four-year plan of what they're going to do to secure or eliminate their stocks, so they can come back to them and say, so where are you on this schedule?
Stephen Rademacher, how difficult would it be for a terrorist to get hold of the necessary materials to create a bomb, a nuclear weapon that could be activated against not only this country, but anywhere in the world?
The threat of nuclear terrorism is a multidimensional threat. And this summit, it's a worthy exercise, but it's only addressing one of the dimensions, and that's the dimension of potential terrorist seizure or theft of highly enriched uranium, for example, at a nuclear research reactor somewhere in the world. And it's very important to address this. In fact, the international community has been addressing this for a long time. During the Bush administration, there were 18 of these operations, like the one that just took place in Chile.
18.
This is the 19th such operation. This is not a new discovery that this threat exists. It's something that the United States government has been working on for a long time. There are other dimensions to the terrorism problem, though, and I would suggest that at least as great as this risk is the risk that a country like Iran might transfer nuclear material to a terrorist group, or a country like North Korea might sell a nuclear weapon or nuclear material to a terrorist group. And David's exactly right. The president here has chosen the least controversial area to begin to work on this, but we can't stop here. And I would frankly be much more impressed if 47 countries were gathered here in Washington to talk about what to do about Iran and North Korea, because I think that's actually the much greater challenge, getting agreement that we need to increase security and guard against theft of nuclear material by terrorists. No one will dissent from that. I mean, there was already unanimity that was correct. What will emerge here is greater commitments to try and operationalize what everybody agrees is the proper approach. But Iran and North Korea are where we really need more international consensus.
But let me understand. Are you saying that you do not think that this gathering is worthwhile in terms of moving toward that commitment?
Sir, I'm not suggesting at all that this is not worthwhile. I think it's a worthy undertaking, but I would see it as just a beginning. And I don't think anyone should leave this summit saying, well, we've solved the risk of nuclear terrorism because we have a four-year work plan that everyone's agreed to. Even if that four-year work plan is fully realized at the end of 4 years, there will remain many other dimensions to the threat of nuclear terrorism, and those need to be addressed as well.
Joseph Cirincione.
Well, Steve is right that there's been broad agreement among many of the key states, but we've had trouble translating that agreement into action. So we've had these kind of programs underway since 1991, since Congress started them. Sam Nunn, Richard Lugar, bipartisan operation, Democrat and Republican cooperating to start what's now known as the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Programs. So we've been securing material in Russia, in Kazakhstan, in Ukraine, in Belarus. But we still have this extremely serious problem where some countries don't want to take up the expense or the difficulty to control the material or control their exports. And so you've got to get this accelerated. We don't have all day for this. Sam Nunn likes to say we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe, and I agree. Most experts think if you do what the president has outlined here, you can prevent nuclear proliferation. If you fail, one of these capitals represented here today is going to go up in a mushroom cloud sometime in the next couple of decades. That's the urgency the president is bringing to it.
What about Stephen Rademacher's point that to focus on Iran would have been the more productive approach.
Iran is a serious problem. There's no question it's a threat, but it is not our most serious problem. And I think politics play in this a lot. What's the most dangerous country in the world right now for the United States? It is not Iran. They do not have a nuclear weapon. They're at least 2 to 5 years away from getting a nuclear weapon. For my money, it is Pakistan. It is Pakistan, an unstable government, enough material for 60 to 100 nuclear weapons, strong Islamic fundamentalist influences in the military and intelligence apparatus, Osama bin Laden in the country, 60 kilometers away from nuclear facilities. It's not that the material's not secure today. It is. It's that the government isn't secure. And if that government stumbles, if it splits, who gets the material? Who gets the weapon? Who gets the scientists? And that's the mistake of focusing so much on this rogue state threat. It's all states where this material is. It's all states with nuclear weapons. You got to go after the weapons and the material.
Stephen Rademacher.
The United States has undertaken efforts to increase security of nuclear material in Pakistan. I agree, it's a big problem, but I certainly wouldn't want to go down this road of suggesting that Pakistan is a bigger threat than Iran. There's this dream of a nuclear-free world, and the president and others keep talking about this. That dream will go up in smoke if Iran succeeds in producing a nuclear weapon. It is the biggest single threat to the nuclear nonproliferation regime.
David Sanger.
I think both of these statements are right. Pakistan, I think, is probably the biggest outstanding security concern because it's got 60 to 100 nuclear weapons, and as I mentioned before, they're continuing to produce. Iran is a big concern because it is on its way. North Korea, a bigger one because it has a proven record of selling its technology.
And, of course, not invited to this summit.
Neither Iran nor North Korea.
So nuclear policy...
Hold on. David Sanger of the New York Times. Short break. We'll be right back. And we're talking about the meeting of nuclear possessors and non-possessors at this nuclear summit that President Obama has called here in Washington today. We have three guests with us, Joseph Cirincione. He's president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a foundation that promotes a nuclear-free world. Stephen Rademacher is senior counsel with the BGR Group, former assistant secretary of state from 2002 to 2006, where he directed nonproliferation policy toward Iran and North Korea. And David Sanger, he's chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and the Challenges to American Power. Just before the break, we were talking about what is important here. How much highly enriched uranium is needed to build a bomb?
Yeah. The official figures are about 25 kilograms, so about 55 pounds. Now, uranium is the densest natural material, so that actually occupies a very small space, about the size of a grapefruit. If you know what you're doing, you can do it with less. But the threat is that of the over 100 tons of this material that is scattered in 40 nations around the world, Al-Qaeda only needs to get 55 pounds of it. With that and a determined effort, they could build a crude nuclear device that could destroy Washington, New York, Paris, or Moscow.
So what you're saying is, how do you keep that small amount out of the hands of terrorist Stephen Rademacher?
It's a challenge, particularly given that there are research reactors all over the world that have highly enriched uranium as their fuel source. And as I indicated earlier, it's been a major effort of the Energy Department since 2002 to go around the world and buy up or otherwise persuade countries to convert their research reactors from high-enriched uranium fuel to low-enriched uranium fuel, which does not present the same risks because low-enriched uranium cannot be turned into a bomb.
But, David Sanger, what about the increased use of nuclear power around the world? Does that present an even more opportunity or greater opportunity?
Well, it can, depending on how well those reactors and the production facilities are designed. The fuel that you use for a nuclear reactor is enriched at a very low percentage and can't be used in a weapon. But to build a nuclear reactor, a country learns frequently the process that's involved in doing that enrichment. And if you keep enriching, then you can get to bomb grade. And that's the Iran problem, that mm-hmm. they've said that they've started for fuel for a reactor and we're concerned that they're moving up to a weapons grade. The other problem is that most reactors, then you create a waste, a fuel waste, that includes a lot of plutonium. And if that is reprocessed, that waste can then be turned into a plutonium weapon. And some countries, Pakistan is one of them, are building reactors precisely to create the plutonium waste that then creates a plutonium bomb. So you've got to be able to control both ends of the process.
And what about the U.S.? Does it have all of its nuclear material secured, Joe?
Yes, we do. And even though some of that material is in university research reactors, MIT has a reactor that uses highly enriched uranium. Bob Gates's former university down in Texas has a research reactor that uses highly enriched uranium. These should be at the top of our list of conversion plans. The problem isn't so much knowing where the material is. It's upgrading the security facilities so that it's tight enough. It's convincing countries that maybe don't think this is a serious problem to undertake the expense and the difficulty of upgrading it. But we can do this job. We haven't lost an ounce of gold from Fort Knox. That we should not lose an ounce of highly enriched uranium. The president's got the right time frame. Do this in 4 years. It isn't that other administrations haven't been doing it. The Clinton administration did it, and as Steve points out, the Bush administration accelerated the programs. And they've been converting somewhere between 5 and 7 reactors a year around the world. The problem is there's 100 such reactors. So let's accelerate it. Let's get the job done now before Al-Qaeda beats us to it.
Steve.
I agree entirely, and I think it needs to be a top priority, and I think it has been for the last several administrations. There's no new discovery here that this is a mm-hmm. problem. I think this exercise that we're seeing in Washington today is basically a goal-setting exercise. But as I said earlier, I think we shouldn't content ourselves that we solved the risk
right.
of nuclear terrorism if we manage to get all of these highly enriched uranium sources all over the world under control, because there are other dimensions to the problem that are equally serious.
Right, and this is a multidimensional problem. You've got to move at many levels at once, and moves on one level affect the other. So you've got to show the U.S. is serious about disarmament in order to get some of these other countries to agree not to proliferate. You've got to contain Iran and North Korea, or else you'll have a cascade of proliferation. You've got to cascade the material. You have to move on multiple levels at once. Fortunately, we seem to be doing that.
Nothing in this world is done without political considerations. What is the political pushback the president is hearing about last week's agreement with the Russians on nonproliferation, David?
Well, he did two things last week. Early in the week, he turned out the administration's fundamental nuclear strategy called the Nuclear Posture Review. Every new president does that. And then he flew off to Prague and signed the New START agreement, which is basically a continuation of the old arms control effort with the Russians. Of those two documents, I found START a whole lot less interesting than the new strategy. The reason is that START is building on something that has been going on for many years. President Bush signed the Moscow Treaty a number of years ago. Depending on how you read the counting rules in this new treaty, it's not going to necessarily require a very big cut on either the Russian side or the U.S. side. It's in the right direction, not a very big cut. The hard negotiation with the Russians is going to be the next one to try to get them and us down below 1,000 weapons. The strategy review is the one that picked up all of the political flack, Diane. That had two major elements to it. One of them was that the president declared that the United States would never need to develop new nuclear weapons. We could basically recycle our old material. There are many who don't agree with that, and even his own defense secretary, Robert Gates, had been in favor of a replacement weapon, a more reliable replacement weapon, as he called it, when he was working for President Bush. And, you know, his opinion has changed because his boss's opinion has changed, and his boss changed. But he created a few outs in the policy so that if in the future the United States feels it needs a new weapon, they can go to the president and get an exemption. The second really interesting thing, and this was the one that really, I think, kicked up conservatives, everybody, including Sarah Palin, who had an interesting back and forth with President Obama at distance last week, was his decision to declare that if you are a non-nuclear state and you are in good standing in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which is the big exemption for North Korea and Iran, then the United States commits to never threaten to use a nuclear weapon against you, even if you attacked the U.S. with a biological weapon, a chemical weapon, a cyber weapon. There would be an overwhelming response, the president said, but it would be an overwhelming conventional response. Now, a lot of the conservatives who came out said, this basically ties our hands behind our back. Should always be able to use the nuclear arsenal as a deterrent for non-nuclear attacks. That's what the president has walked away from.
Steve.
The philosophy of the Obama administration on the Iran and North Korea problems, I think, is reflected in the policies we see in the Nuclear Posture Review and in this New START agreement with Russia. The animating philosophy of the administration is that if the United States moves more quickly toward nuclear disarmament, that this will somehow help us solve the Iran and North Korea problems. Personally, I think there's very little evidence. In fact, I'm aware of no evidence that supports that notion. But we will see. There will be a review conference for the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in May, and maybe the international community will be inspired by what's happened here and show an unanticipated level of cooperation with the United States in addressing Iran and North Korea. I will be shocked if that's true. I think President Obama has changed declaratory policy in certain marginal respects, frankly. Most of the apparent what when you read the document closely, most of the changes are actually less far-reaching than they first appear. They're caveated. They're exceptions to them embedded within the document. So I'm really not with those on the Republican side who say that this is a disastrous and dangerous document. I'm more with those who say, this is in some ways a disingenuous document because it purports to affect more change than it really does.
Interesting. Had there been a camera here in the studio, our listeners would have seen Joe Cirincione react rather strongly to your comments. Go ahead, Joe.
There is a very strong historical record that shows that progress on reducing nuclear weapons correlates to progress on stopping other countries from getting their nuclear weapons. And this has been well recognized in national intelligence assessments from the Eisenhower years on. I know this because I did research and wrote a paper on this for the U.S. Strategic Posture Commission, headed up by Secretary Perry and Secretary Schlesinger. It's very clear in the 1960s, when it looked like the U.S. and Russia were in an unlimited arms race, that many other countries considered having these weapons. When it became clear by the end of that decade that the U.S. And Russia were willing to engage in arms control talks, had negotiated the nonproliferation treaty, you saw other countries lose interest in this. The record is actually crystal clear, and it only makes sense. If you're another country and you think that there's a group of countries that want to keep these weapons forever, want to improve them, want to extend them, want to use them as power and a threat over you, of course you're going to be interested in getting other weapons. And as you see the other countries moving away from that, you start joining this international trend. It's not a perfect correlation, but it is very, very strong, and the intelligence estimates have always reflected this.
David.
You know, Steve raised a very interesting point when he said that, you know, you'll see whether or not this strategy begins to work when there's this once every 5 year review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that starts in New York. I think you'll see one other difference, though, from the Obama administration. The last review 5 years ago took place under the Bush administration. I think, Steve, you represented
I was the head of the U.S. delegation.
What was interesting there was that neither the Secretary of State at the time, Condoleezza Rice, nor President Bush came to the conference. And I think the way many people who were at the conference read that was that the U.S. wasn't really interested in amending the treaty or even in demonstrating whether or not it was willing to fulfill its own obligation in the treaty, which is to build down the number of weapons that the U.S. and Russia have. All the nuclear powers who are in it have that obligation. I suspect you're going to see much higher U.S. representation next month.
David Sanger, The New York Times. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And speaking of no-shows, we've already had a number of emails about Benjamin Netanyahu's failure or his decision not to show up at this particular summit. How come, Joe?
Well, his stated reason is that he felt he was walking into a trap, that some countries, and I think the ones that have been mentioned are Turkey and Egypt, were going to use this to attack Israel. Israel is a nuclear-armed state. It's had nuclear weapons since 1968, but it neither confirms nor denies those weapons. I actually think he missed an opportunity here. It's a mistake. Israel actually has a quite strong nonproliferation record in recent decades, hasn't let any of its technology go out to other countries. Its program has not been a stimulus to an arms race in the Middle East. It just hasn't. Iran is much more of a stimulus to other countries
when
getting weapons.
When you say Israel made a mistake, what do you mean?
I think it was a chance for Netanyahu to take the world stage and be part of this nuclear discussion in a way they haven't been yet, and to demonstrate Israel's commitments to securing nuclear materials, which they do, to preventing nuclear states. In some ways, President Obama sort of set the stage perfectly to do this. They're not in the nonproliferation treaty. Neither is India or Pakistan. India and Pakistan are coming to this. It's a new mechanism the president is developing here. Israel should be part of it at the highest level.
Diane, I said earlier in the program that I would be more impressed with this gathering of 47 world leaders if they were addressing Iran and North Korea as well as the problem of nuclear material around the world. But it's clear that the Obama administration made a conscious decision to try and limit the agenda to what was non-controversial. And I think what you see in Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision is a concern on his part that the Obama administration had failed to prevent or gain agreement that would have prevented some of the countries from trying to expand the agenda to deal with one contentious issue. To me, that's something of a diplomatic failure because for some reason the administration was able to succeed in preventing the agenda from being expanded to deal with problems like Iran and North Korea. It would have been a travesty for them to come here and not talk about Iran and North Korea and instead talk about Israel as if it were some sort of
an Obama failure or a Netanyahu failure.
I would say that it was President Obama who convened the meeting, and he has kept Iran and North Korea off the agenda. Obviously, Netanyahu was not satisfied that he was going to succeed in keeping Israel off the agenda.
You know, President Obama is going to be sitting in the chair the entire time during the main part of the summit, which starts tonight with a dinner and then runs through three sessions tomorrow. So you know, I think that the Israelis could have known that President Obama is going to be pretty well in control of keeping people on the subject, and the agendas are pretty well laid out. But at the same time, you have to think back about something that Joe said here, which is the Israelis have had nuclear weapons since 1968, okay? So we're 42...
But have never quite admitted.
But we're 42 years into this, and this is not the best-kept national security secret,
exactly,
you know, on Earth. So we may have reached a moment where if you're going to debate the wisdom of President Obama's goal of building down to zero for all states, somebody's going to have, sooner or later, the Israelis are going to have to start openly talking about their nuclear arsenal, how they keep it, what kind of safety precautions, which as Joe has pointed out, are said to be quite good, and then talk about its future. And the reason they've got to go do that is that many other states in the Middle East are going to raise as a reason not to press the Iranians this concept that maybe the Mideast should be a nuclear-free zone, which is their way of forcing the Israelis to give up all of their of the arsenal. Well, that discussion's going to happen whether the Israelis come to the meetings or they don't come to the meetings. And I thought that this last-minute decision not to come reflected an inability by the Israelis to quite figure out how it is they were going to engage in that conversation.
I think that's exactly
David
right.
David Sanger, the New York Times, Joseph Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund, and Stephen Rademacher, former Assistant Secretary of State. Short break, then your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The lives of an ordinary family shattered by the tragic events of a New Year's Day morning. Best-selling author Anna Quinlan brings us her new novel about one mother's decision to carry on after the security of her middle-class life is destroyed. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back as we talk about the National Security Summit opening in Washington today. We'll open the phones now first to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Jeff. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, ma'am. I had a simple point, given the nature of this summit, implement ways to prevent these bombs of getting into the wrong hands. My question is burdening me is this. Is there any way for these bombs to ever be in the right hands?
Joe.
Well, that's a very good question. You know, each country historically looks at their nuclear arsenals safe and a vital means for their security, and the problem is really the other guy's bombs. The problem is that every country sees that. India thinks that its bombs are perfectly reasonable, and Pakistan is the crazy one. China thinks, of course, it has to have nuclear weapons. Look at America and Russia. And so when you look at this historically, you realize that the only way to undo this nuclear reaction chain is to take it apart all at once. And that's, in essence, what you see the current administration doing in the way that Ronald Reagan did it. You start with the biggest arsenals. The United States and Russia have 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world. So you've got to start taking those down and demonstrating that we no longer think of them as prestige items or vital to U.S. national security. Other countries shouldn't. And the good news here is that it's completely safe for us to do them. We don't need certainly thousands of nuclear weapons. We currently have about 10,000 total, about 5,000 in the active stockpile. We could go down to several hundred and not sacrifice one iota of nuclear security. In fact, the Air Force Chief of Policy and Planning just wrote an article recommending that we go down unilaterally to 311. He said this was the figure we could use, and we could accomplish all our military missions.
All right, to Fabrice in Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diana. Good morning to you. I guess I have first. I would like to applaud the effort of Obama administration to raise awareness on the threat of nuclear weapon. There's no doubt that nuclear weapon in the wrong hand would be a threat against humankind. But the reality is this. The military power, and some of your guests mentioned it, military power has been used for decades and as an effective tool in foreign relations. And I would take, for example, that evidence suggests that if Iran get a nuclear weapon now, the game and the rules of the game will change in the Middle East. So my reflection is this. I doubt that states around the world will discount this reality that nuclear weapon can be an effective tool in diplomatic relationship just for the sake of reaching a world without nuclear weapon. So anyway, that's just my reflection.
Stephen.
I think we could all agree the world would be a better place if nuclear weapons had never been invented. But for better or worse, they were invented, and the know-how has proliferated, and there are a number of countries that today possess these weapons. That knowledge cannot be eradicated, and we could all hope that one day there will be some sort of international consensus to completely eliminate them. But I think even President Obama says we are a long way away from achieving that nirvana. President Obama tells us that he thinks we will continue to have nuclear weapons for the rest of his lifetime. David, for example, talked about the next round of nuclear arms reductions negotiations between the United States and Russia. I'll predict here today there's not going to be another round of nuclear arms reductions now negotiated by this administration with Russia. Now, they may try to sit down to talk, but fundamentally, Russia does not share this vision of a world without nuclear weapons. I mean, and they say that quite frankly. They say that in today's security environment, nuclear weapons are more important to them than ever before. So the idea that they're going to sit down and negotiate another round of deep reductions, I think, is wishful thinking.
Why did they sit down last week?
Well, if you analyze the numbers, and we have great insight into what the existing force levels are on the Russian side and on the U.S. side, the net effect of this agreement is basically to bring the U.S. to bring the legal ceiling down to the Russian level. Virtually no reductions are required on the Russian side. They're already at this level. So, of course, it's in Russia's interest to persuade the United States to give up nuclear weapons and achieve parity with them at a lower level. The question in a follow-on negotiation would be to go even lower. And I think there are a whole bunch of reasons why that's very unlikely to happen. First, Russia's not interested. Second, they will insist on addressing missile defense in any follow-on negotiation. That is a complete non-starter on the U.S. side. And even the Nuclear Posture Review, President Obama's Nuclear Posture Review issued last week, says that is a non-starter. We will not negotiate limitations on missile defense. That's Obama's policy now. And on the U.S. side, I think any consideration of deeper strategic nuclear reductions could only be contemplated in a context of deep reductions in the tactical nuclear weapons. These are the nuclear weapons that are designed to be used in Europe, not between the United States and Russia. And the Russians have zero interest in, and they have never been willing to consider any sort of negotiated, even transparency with respect to tactical nuclear weapons, much less negotiated mandatory reductions.
Here's an email from Claude in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. He says, I assume building a nuclear bomb is not something that could be done in a mountain cave. If Al-Qaeda did get hold of the right materials, where would they find a lab or other facilities to create a bomb? David?
Well, Al-Qaeda is largely in Pakistan, and the big concern about Pakistan is the insider threat. Pakistan has a big nuclear infrastructure. There are about 70,000 people who work in the Pakistani nuclear infrastructure. About 2,000 to 3,000 of those have what the Pakistanis call critical knowledge, that is, the ability to take the material, design a bomb. So I think the concern is not that the bomb would be designed and built in a cave, but rather that it would be designed and built in the Khan Research Lab, named for A.Q. Khan, the man who became the biggest proliferator in history, and that it would slip its way out, or that some of the material would slip its way out. And, you know, as Joe pointed out before, the bomb we're worried about right now is not a particularly sophisticated one that goes on a missile across the ocean. We're worried about the old 1940s slam two hemispheres of highly enriched uranium together to make one crude explosion. And that isn't all that complicated.
Here is an email from Joe who says, suppose a terrorist did destroy a city or our capital, what would the reaction of the U.S. be? Certainly any country found culpable would know that we would very well respond in kind.
This would be undoubtedly the worst catastrophe in American history. You have to understand what would happen. Even this crude device, a Hiroshima-sized bomb, would kill hundreds of thousands of people, cause trillions of dollars of economic damage, and probably change our political structure forever. There would be popular calls for draconian measures to prevent another such attack. It wouldn't be a dictator or a president trying to become a dictator. It would be what the people were demanding. You could take the Bill of Rights and put it up on the shelf, and you might never see it again. And that reaction would probably take place in other nations as well after they saw the destruction of this. What then happens? Could you find out who supplied the material? It's actually, there's some chance we could. We have something called nuclear forensics. Nuclear material has kind of a fingerprint to it, and there's a chance you could find out this was made in another country. Well, suppose you find out it was Russian source material. Well, what do you do about that? Or Pakistani source material? Do you actually go attack Islamabad for this? The problem with the terrorist attack is not, number one, you can't deter it, and number two, there's really no good response to it because these people don't have territory or national territories to defend. Let me just finally say, I want to take Steve's bet. I want to bet Steve dinner that we will have another round of negotiations. I'll even top that. I think we're going to get this START treaty ratified with an overwhelming bipartisan majority because of what Steve says. It's actually very non-controversial. It doesn't make many changes in either the U.S. or the Russian structure. It's a very practical thing to do, supported by our military and security leaders. So I'll take that bet, and you name the dinner. Maybe you don't
Let's
want to have dinner
with me. Let's make an expensive restaurant, Joe.
Norris. How's Norris?
Do you agree with Joe about ratification by the Senate?
I think this probably will get ratified by the Senate. However, I think the next thing that President Obama wants to get, which is the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which failed in 1999, I think that's going to be the big fight. And that would simply make sure that the United States could not conduct additional nuclear tests. I wanted to leap in on one point that that Joe made. I think everything he said about how it's very hard to deter terrorist attacks is correct. Attribution takes a long time. It could be weeks or months before somebody could go to the president and say where this material came from. There's a third issue that goes to the chaos that could be created from this. Let's say, and this is the scenario that plays out in American you know, military planners' nightmares. Let's say that a terrorist group got a hold of one weapon and they set it off in some American city, God forbid. Okay? What's the next thing they're going to do? They're going to go on the radio and they're going to say, you know, we have 10 of these, even if they only had one and they had just shot it off. And in 3 days, it's going to go off in this city. And in 5 days, it's going to go off in that city. And in 7 days, okay, and they'll have the credibility that comes from one just having been detonated. So you could see every American major city get emptied out
right.
on the basis of a completely fabricated threat.
But where are they going to go?
Good question. And more people will die getting mm-hmm. out of the cities and in the chaos that comes from that than would if a weapon actually probably went off.
And there's also more. The U.S. ports would probably shut down if this thing was thought to have been shipped in. Well, are you going to accept another container ship after this has just happened? I mean, the implications of this are just enormous, and
Which
that's why people are concentrating on this.
The president is concentrating on this particular issue. To West Palm Beach, Florida. Simon, you're on the air.
Yes. It seemed to me that the nuclear cut was pretty much out of the bag anyhow. The dissolving Soviet empire, I believe there were 85 suitcase bombs that were unaccounted for. And Joseph Stiglitz, the award-winning Nobel laureate, in his book says that the United States agency, which was charged with getting the waste from the nuclear reactors so that it couldn't be turned into weaponizable material, when it was privatized, according to Stiglitz in his book, wrote to the Russians, who were prepared to provide 3 times as much nuclear waste back to the United States if the payments to them were prorated, saying to them not to make that public, and paying what, in Joseph Stiglitz's words, were, and this was his quote, hush money for them to keep it quiet. His speculation was that that corporation, having been privatized, realized that it could sell the stuff on elsewhere in the world for greater profit.
Simon, thanks for your call. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Stephen.
The caller's point underscores what I think we agreed on earlier, which is the threat of nuclear terrorism is multidimensional. One of the dimensions is research reactors all over the world with highly enriched uranium, where terrorists could seize the material. Pakistan, another potential source. You heard me earlier speaking about Iran and North Korea as potential sources. The former Soviet Union, Russia, another source. Now, if there's any real hero or group of heroes in this whole effort, it's Senators Sam Nunn and Dick Lugar, who in 1991 had the foresight to understand that we needed to get control of the nuclear material and the weapons, not just the material, but the actual weapons in the former Soviet Union, and try to prevent them from leaking to other countries, to terrorist groups, to criminal gangs, to whomever. And over the last 20 years, we have spent tens of billions of dollars on these programs. Not all the money has been well spent, frankly. Some of it has gone to waste. But given the enormity of the threat, I have a hard time dwelling on the waste. I dwell more on what's been accomplished, and more needs to be done. But the caller is absolutely right. Among the potential sources of terrorist access to a nuclear weapon is the former Soviet Union.
So then, gentlemen, what do you see as the most significant prospective outcome of this summit?
There will be a joint action plan, which will set real goals and a timetable. But what you want is to see individual countries stepping up to the plate. We're making commitments the way Chile just did a few weeks ago. They gave up a bomb's worth of highly enriched uranium from one of their research reactors. It was shipped out by an American, heavily armed American team in something of a Mission Impossible operation during the earthquake. So you want to see more countries at this summit stepping up and saying, we're going to do this and this and this by date certain. I would also like these countries to agree to come back in 2 years and assess the progress.
I agree with that. I think, as I said earlier, this was the Chile operation was the 19th time since 2002 that the United States has sent teams from the Department of Energy into a foreign country to retrieve highly mm-hmm. enriched uranium. We hope to see a lot more operations like that. Hopefully the deadlines that are set at this meeting will facilitate additional work in that regard.
And you, David.
Well, I think that the really interesting question coming out of this meeting is, does the president get the political momentum to go on to the much harder issues that we've all, I think, agreed he's got to take on next. And that includes whether or not he's going to get a treaty or an agreement to cut off the production of additional material, especially at a time that India and Pakistan are building on more and others are considering it. And then whether this focuses the mind on the problem of Iran and of North Korea. And that's going to be the much harder political issue. You know, this afternoon, the president's going to see President Hu Jintao of China, who's coming in for this. And, you know, while the Iran issue is not on the agenda of the summit, it sure is on the agenda of these individual conversations. And I think the big question is, on the Iran-related issue that's immediately before us, which is sanctions that they're seeking in the United Nations. And there were three passed during the Bush administration. None of them turned out to be strong enough to change Iran's behavior. The question is, can President Obama convince the Chinese to go along with a set of sanctions that actually might change behavior? And that's going to be a big uphill push.
Should Iran and North Korea have been invited to this summit?
Oh, no. There's no way. No, they're part of the problem. They're not part of the solution at this point.
Do you agree with that, Stephen?
I agree entirely. They would have had nothing positive to contribute. I will note this big non-proliferation meeting in New York in May. Iran will be there. Iran will have to agree to any decisions that are taken. So the idea that that conference will make progress against Iran, I think, is wishful thinking.
I'll take that bet, too.
Lots of betting. Stephen Rademacher, Joseph Cerencioni, David Sanger, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.